Fantastic. We have a scholar amongst us now. Do you know what day it is today? Okay. What else? January. What's the date? January. It's 2013, but January 14th. And every year, on January 14th, there's this very special day. What is that? Anyone know? Makra Sankranti. What is Makra Sankranti, anyway? Besides a big day to have a festival in Bombay. What's Makra Sankranti?
The sun travels on the northern hemisphere.
Don't know. Would you like to know? You have a cold? Hope you get over your cold. What is it? Who is saying? Yes?
The sun travels on the northern side. It travels from east to west on the north side.
The sun travels from east to west on the north side.
Yeah, on the north direction.
Okay. What do you know what that means? The sun travels from east to west in a northerly direction?
And it is the daytime for the...
Let's do the first one, one at a time, before we go to the second one. I'll help you all. See if our little scholar here knows the answer to this question. Does the sun move around the earth, or the earth moves around the sun? Does the earth move around the sun, or does the sun move around the earth?
Earth moves around the sun.
Anybody want to say anything different? Sun moves around the earth. Anybody want to say anything different? It's both. What? What? So, here's the Earth planet. A little bigger, but, you know, there's the Earth planet. The sun has a relative motion to the Earth that is counterclockwise, or east to west. Right? East to west. Counterclockwise motion. So, June 14th, in the northern hemisphere, so this is the earth and here's the northern hemisphere of the earth, the days are longest and the nights are shortest. That's called summer solstice. And then the sun moves. Each year the sun moves one full rotation, heading in a southerly direction towards the equator. And when it crosses the equator, the days and nights are equal. That's called equinox. And then the sun keeps moving in a southerly direction to Makra Sankranti, which is today, where for the northern hemisphere, the days are shortest and the nights are longest. And then when the sun starts moving in now northerly direction, going from the southernmost part of its orbit around the Earth, and then heading towards the hemisphere, towards the equator again, that's today. It's in Bhagavad Gita, it's spoken of as the period when the sun is moving in the northerly direction is an auspicious time for yogis to give up their body, like Bhishma Dev gave up his body today, or so many years ago, on this Makra Sankranti day, because it was an auspicious time and he had the will, he could leave his body at will or stay as he wanted. So he gave up his body at that time. So this relative motion thing, is described in the Bhagavatam in language that sounds primitive, but it's actually amazingly sophisticated. Because there are places where it describes the earth moving around the sun, and there are places where it describes the sun moving around the earth. And Maharaj Parikshit, hearing that, asks Shukadeva Goswami for an explanation. Is it this or is it that? And he gives what sounds, so I'm going to say it slowly twice. And so listen carefully. He gives the description of a potter's wheel. So the potter's wheel is moving in a clockwise direction. Imagine. So the hands, like the hands of a clock, moving in a clockwise direction. The potter's wheel spinning very, very fast. And there's an ant on the potter's wheel. So which direction is the ant moving? Clockwise, because he's on the potter's wheel that's moving clockwise. But he's also supposing the ant is walking slowly in a counterclockwise direction. So you can say he's also moving in a counterclockwise direction, very slowly. And in the course of one complete revolution of the potter's wheel, that's how long it takes him 1 year to walk around. The potter's wheel. That's the motion of the sun in relation to the earth. Because the earth is spinning. That's like the potter's wheel. It's spinning very fast. The earth is spinning very fast. So in relation to the earth spinning very fast, the motion of the earth spinning and the position of the sun is the sun rises in the east, usually, and it sets in the west, usually. But because of that movement that's called the ecliptic, the motion of the sun as it moves on the ecliptic plane in relation to the earth, moving in a counterclockwise direction, or from west to east. So the sun is moving both west to east and east to west, depending on, well, where do you go? Jamuna Jivara. Depending on the perspective. So I'll say it again. Imagine a potter's wheel. This is the Bhagavatam's language. There's a verse in the fifth canto that says this. It's Shukadeva Goswami's answer. Which direction is the sun moving, east to west or west to east? He gives the example of an ant spinning on a potter's wheel, or on a potter's wheel that's spinning, in a clockwise direction, so the ant is moving in a clockwise direction with the potter's wheel. But very slowly he's walking in a counterclockwise direction. So one can also say the ant is moving in a counterclockwise direction. So similarly, the sun is moving west to east and east to west in relation to the earth. One is the spinning of the earth, and the other is the movement of the sun around the earth on the ecliptic. So it's by astrological consideration and astronomical consideration, it's a very auspicious day today. And its auspiciousness is celebrated in different ways in different places in our Gaudiya Vaishnava calendar. The one of the events that's celebrated is Ganga Sagara. And Ganga Sagara Mela is today. So many, just like many Vaishnavs go to Jagannath Puri to observe the Jagannath Rath Yatra. Similarly, many millions and millions and millions of Vaishnavas go to where the Ganga flows into the ocean, and they go there on Makara Sankranti to take their sacred bath on Makara Sankranti. In fact, there's a very nice, there's two very nice stories related to Jagannath Puri. Maybe some of you have been to Jagannath Puri for our yatras, you'll remember these. But one of them is in relation to Ganga Mata Goswamini. Remember this one? She, before she was known as Ganga Mata, she was known as Sachi. And she was a disciple of Haridas Pandit, who lived in Vrindavan. Haridas Pandit was a grand disciple of Gadadhar Pandit. And he was very knowledgeable in the Srimad Bhagavatam, as was his spiritual master's spiritual master. So Sachi heard from him, Srimad Bhagavatam, every day. And she was incredibly spiritually elevated, very materially detached, very spiritually tuned in. And hearing from Haridas Pandit, she became a greatly qualified speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam. This, as Prabhupada said, that was his qualification. He just heard from his Guru Maharaj. He said, sometimes I would understand, sometimes I would not understand, but I would stay and listen. And that is my qualification. Prabhupada spoke like that about himself. Because Bhaktisiddhanta was speaking such lofty language that it was very hard to understand him. But he would stay and listen. In fact, Prabhupada commented, when it was time for Prabhupada's initiation, there were many persons in the assembly, and when Abhay's name was called, he became initiated Abhay Charan. But when Abhay was called and he stood up, Bhaktisiddhanta said, ah, I have marked him. He is very keen to hear. And that was his qualification, to speak, because he heard. So Sachi, she also heard from Haridas Pandit. And after some time, in addition to chanting, to living at Radha Kund with one of her god sisters, who was chanting the same number of rounds every day that Haridas Thakur chanted every day, which is a lot of rounds, 64 times 3 rounds of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra every day. It's like superhuman. We shouldn't be embarrassed that we can't do that. It's superhuman. She was associating with a superhuman god sister. And after some time, Haridas Pandit gave her some service to leave Vrindavan and Radha Kund and go to Puri and worship the deity of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, because there was no one worshipping his deity. This was only just a short while after Lord Chaitanya's presence. That's how quickly things deteriorate. So be very careful about deity installations, because present generation may be able to maintain, and next generation, the next generation. So she went to Puri on the order of her spiritual master. She didn't want to leave Vrindavan, but she had an order and she left. And those of you that know about the mood of worship in Puri, it's very smarta, brahmana-oriented, and ladies don't worship deities in Puri. What to speak of Damodar Shilas. But she was instructed by her spiritual master, and so she did. And she was so qualified, everyone, you know, believe it or not, in Puri, they accepted. I mean, not initially, they were grumbling, but then when they recognized how spiritually elevated she was, they accepted. And she was told, just stay there. Don't leave. Just stay there for the rest of your life and worship his deities. So when Makara Sankranti came and the Ganga Sagra Mela came, she wanted to go because it's a wonderful occasion and very spiritually elevating and uplifting. But she was given an order by her spiritual master, so she had to stay. So when she was resting at night, this evening, like now, Lord Jagannath appeared in a dream. I believe it was Lord Jagannath appeared in a dream and said, the Sweta Ganga, which is very near to your residence, this Kund, is not different than the Ganga. So you can take your bath in the Ganga late at night when no one's around, and then you won't, your shyness won't be invaded. You can take bath there. So she was very happy to receive this instruction. So she went alone and began taking her bath in the Sweta Ganga. The place is still there today. And as she was bathing, the water rose and rose and rose and rose, high and high and high, and waves started carrying her. This is not so long ago this happened. Through the streets of Puri and right into the Jagannath temple. And then the waves subsided. The water was all, the floor was all wet, and the guards heard this noise, and they went in and they saw what they thought was a thief in the middle of the temple, come to steal the paraphernalia of Lord Jagannath. Posing as a sadhu lady, they put her in jail. That very night, the king of Puri had a dream where Lord Jagannath came and chastised him severely. Said, this is my great devotee. I've brought her here so I could have her association on Makara Sankranti. And your guards have put her in jail. You've made a big offense. You at once personally go to the jail, release her from jail, fall at her feet, and beg for her forgiveness, and plead with her to accept her, to accept you as her disciple. That was the king getting a dream from Lord Jagannath. So the king went to the prison, and there was Sachi, and he immediately did everything that Jagannath said to do. And she just laughed and said, Jagannath has such a sense of humor. Because the king said the reason all this happened was Jagannath wanted to have your darshan on this auspicious day. He, the Supreme Lord, loves his devotee as much as the devotee loves the Supreme Lord. It's not a one-way love, it's love. So he reciprocates in wonderful, amazing ways with his devotees, sometimes according to his pleasure. So, according to Lord Jagannath's intent, she had no desire for something like that, but it was the Jagannath's order, and so she accepted the king as her disciple. And later became known as Ganga Mata Goswamini. One of the members of our disciplic line who are embodied in a female body, but so eminently spiritually qualified, everyone accepted her as a spiritual master, Diksha Guru, and accepted initiation from her. Very special position. In Puri, the king became her disciple. And that same Sweta Ganga, very nice place, very sacred place, there was one Pujari from the Jagannath temple who went there. Same thing, he had a vow that he wouldn't leave Puri because he had some service to Jagannath to do. So on Makara Sankranti, he went to Sweta Ganga to take his bath. And when he entered into the Sweta Ganga, he, as we see people do, he dipped his whole body under the water. And when he came up, he was at Ganga Sagara. And he was very amazed. Look at this. This doesn't look like Puri. This is some other place. And he asked, where am I? What is this? And he said, oh, this is Ganga Sagara. You've come this auspicious day. And as he came out of the Ganga, right by the bank of the river, was a young woman waiting. And the woman said, you're my husband. He said, what? And she said, I've been praying to the Supreme Lord for a qualified husband, and he appeared in my dream and said that you would come from this very place, coming directly from Puri. Are you a resident of Puri? Yes. He said, well, you're my husband. This is Lord Jagannath's plan. So he accepted that it was Jagannath's plan. Otherwise, how to explain something so mysterious like this? And the next day, after Makara Sankranti, the next morning, He went to take his bath, dipped his body into the Ganga, and when he came out, he was in Sweta Ganga, in Puri. So Lord Jagannath had a plan, and he didn't know what to do. So he didn't say anything to anybody. And he just carried on with his service. Some years passed, and as he was leaving the temple, as we see the pujari leave the temple in Jagannath Puri, there was a woman with a young boy and said, you're my husband. This is your son. For that one day that he was there, they were married and the son was conceived. And then Ganga carried him back to Puri, and he didn't even recognize the woman. And he said, because there's a rule that someone who marries outside of Puri cannot continue in their service to the Jagannath deity. So, don't say anything. So this conversation was going on, some persons overheard it and said, hey, what's going on? One of those. Hey, what's going on? So nothing going on. What do you mean, what's going on? And it went to the head priest. And now I can't remember exactly what happened. The head priest something. The head priest heard the whole story, what the woman had to say, and then asked him, is this true? And he had to say, I can't tell a lie, it's true. So the head priest said, normally this would be against our tradition, but because it's the plan of Lord Jagannath, we can't go against the plan of Lord Jagannath, we have to accept you can continue in your service. But your son cannot continue in the same service that you do, because that's the tradition, because he was born outside of Puri and in this other unique way. So some other service was created by the head priest, so the son and the descendants of the son could do this additional service, because that's the way, the seminal line is how services pass on in Jagannath Puri. On Makara Sankranti, this all happened. Lord Jagannath, who has his sense of humor and his direct interaction with devotees, and he does whatever he wants to do, whenever he wants to do it. So Makara Sankranti, now you know what January 14th is. Next year, January 14th, same thing. Because it's by solar calendar, it's the movement of the sun in relation to the earth. It's not a lunar calendar event, it's a solar calendar event. January 14th, Makara Sankranti, every year. And big celebrations in different parts of India according to local custom. Very auspicious day. On this very auspicious day, Jiva Goswami of the six Goswamis departed from this world. So I'd like to speak something in honor of Jiva Goswami about the life of Jiva Goswami. How you doing? You okay? Can you say something about Jiva Goswami? Who is Jiva Goswami? Yes, you can. He's one of the six Goswamis. There's something. Who is he related to from the other of the six Goswamis? There were three brothers. Rupa, Sanatan, and Anupam. Anupam. Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami were brothers. They had a third brother. His name was Anupam. Anupam Malik. That was the name that was given when all three brothers were basically conscripted into, by force, into the service of Nawab Hussein Shah. Because they were from Saraswat Brahmin families from South India, and through several generations, they moved from Karnataka and gradually into different positions and came to Ramakeli in Bengal at the time. And that was also very near the capital of Nawab Hussein Shah, who recognized the qualification of these three brothers and gave them the following choice. You serve in my government, or I'll torment and torture and kill all the Vaishnavas. Think about it. Let me know which one you want to do. And they didn't want to do either one. But they didn't want the second one. So they accepted service in the government of Nawab Hussein Shah. And the prime minister was of his government was Sanatan Goswami, and the finance minister was Anupam, and Rupa Goswami was the home minister or something like that. And everything was running very nicely because they're so qualified, and everyone trusted them and revered them, and whatever they said, people would do. So it made it really easy for Nawab to go off with his armies and conquer new territory and, you know, be a big hero. Meanwhile, because they were actually great Vaishnavas, they came to hear of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And during Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's, so they began writing letters to him. You know, they didn't send text messages or emails. They, you know, didn't have a postal system either. They wrote something, and then a brahmana would carry the message all the way from West Bengal to Puri. Then Lord Chaitanya was receiving those messages, and he understood their qualification. Of course, there's an eternal relationship between them all, but lila-wise, he could understand their devotion, and so he made a plan to visit them. So the first meeting, there were all three brothers were there in Ramakeli, and Anupam was there, and in Bhakti Ratnakar, which is another book that will someday be published by the BBT, is a description of the lives of devotees of Lord Chaitanya after Lord Chaitanya. Chaitanya Charitamrita describing the lives of devotees during Lord Chaitanya's life and after, primarily after, because Rupa and Sanatana also were during and after, but the description of this encounter is in Chaitanya Charitamrita, and in Bhakti Ratnakar it indicates that even as a very, very small child, Jiva Goswami had been born to Anupam. And according to Bhakti Ratnakar, there was that one time infant Jiva got Lord Chaitanya's association. And as time passed, both his uncle and his two uncles and his father went to Vrindavan. On one travel from Vrindavan back to Puri, Anupam died in the course of the journey, leaving Jiva Goswami without a father, you know, little boy without a father. But his inclination was incredibly spiritually directed. That the description of his childhood is very much like the description of Maharaj Parikshit's life. He was worshipping Krishna and Krishna Balaram as an infant, just like, you know, some children play with toys. Now it's, you know, monsters and dinosaurs and guns and tanks and cars, and his was deities. That was his toys. Deities of Krishna Balaram. And he worshipped them. He revered them and made offerings to them. And he loved them. And they loved him. One day, he had a dream where his deities of Krishna Balaram were there. And then suddenly they transformed into Gornatai. And then they transformed. And then Gornatai came and embraced him in his dream, and he felt ecstatic symptoms, and he woke. He wanted to immediately go to see Lord Nityananda, and he pleaded with his mother, please let me go, please let me go. And she realized I can't say no. So, but she sent an entourage to go with him because he was young. and they went to some places, and then he left just to go to Navadvip, hoping that he could see the places of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. Meanwhile, Lord Nityananda, who is also omniscient, as is Lord Chaitanya, was living in Kardaha. Kardaha is the name of the place where Lord Nityananda lived with Janava and what's his other wife? Janava and Vasudha is her name. Janava and Vasudha. So, from Kardaha, which is, it's like going from Mayapur to Calcutta by foot. He left Kardaha, because Kardaha is very close to Calcutta, and went at once to Navadvip, and there he met Jiva Goswami. Lord Nityananda met Jiva Goswami at the house of Srivas Pandit. And immediately, Jiva Goswami, they had never seen each other, immediately he recognized, this is Lord Nityananda. Because he saw him in a dream. And it was Lord Nityananda. It wasn't like an imaginary Lord Nityananda. It was Lord Nityananda. And he immediately recognized him. And he ran, little boy, and he ran and fell at his feet and was crying and crying. And Lord Nityananda very mercifully placed his feet on his head. And he embraced and were just exhibiting amazing symptoms of ecstatic love. Jiva Goswami said, I've not had the opportunity, other than when I was a little baby, to have Lord Chaitanya's association. But you're still here. Could you show me the places where Lord Chaitanya performed his pastimes and describe his pastimes? So he agreed. And he took Jiva Goswami to all those places of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. A book about that tour has been written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur called Navadvip Dham Mahatmya and Navadvip Dham Parikrama. In detail, the description of that exchange between Lord Nityananda and Jiva Goswami. And some others were sometimes with them as well. Sometimes Srivas, sometimes others. And at the end of that tour, they were both in transcendental happiness. Lord Nityananda, as he did with Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, told him, you now go to Vrindavan and make your residence in Vrindavan and associate with your two uncles, Rupa and Sanatan Goswami. But before you go, go to Benares, which isn't a nice place for those who wish to worship Krishna. It's a seat of very strong impersonalism. So, go there. There's a student of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya whose name is Madhusudana Vachaspati. And he's been trained, listen, he's been trained in the six atheistic doctrines called Sad Darshans, six teachings that take the Vedas and distort the Vedas and arrive at some conclusion other than there's God. Some other conclusion than there's God. Study under him because he knows Lord Chaitanya's teachings perfectly. He learned that from Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He also knows the other ones and he can help you understand that what's misinterpretation, the fallacies of the misinterpretation and the correct interpretation. Yes? So he went and studied with Madhusudana Vachaspati for some time and he was, you know, a super scholar, so he learned very quickly. Before he went to Vrindavan, he had all that preparation. So when he went to Vrindavan and studied under Rupa Goswami, he became a disciple of Rupa Goswami, his uncle. So he learned all the devotional teachings that Lord Chaitanya had given to Rupa Goswami. And by the way, no small point, Lord Chaitanya said to Rupa Goswami, as I am explaining, I said this yesterday, as I am explaining these things to you, you'll realize in full everything about the message, and then you write books on the subject. Imagine hearing from Lord Chaitanya and getting the benediction that the fullness of realization was yours. Just listen. So he then studied under Rupa Goswami. So he had this other, you know, what bhakti isn't, or what the Vedas distorted look like, and then what the bhakti teachings from Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's disciple, then directly from Rupa Goswami. And he is this super scholarly personality. Prabhupada's statement is, never in the history of the world has there been a scholar as eminent as Jiva Goswami. When you read his writings, you'll understand why he spoke like that. They're brilliant. It's not long-winded and wordy. It's just brilliant. He wrote 400,000 verses, just to get some idea of how many 400,000 verses is. Bhagavad Gita, how many verses? 700. Srimad Bhagavatam, 18,000. Mahabharat, 100,000. So it's like he wrote 3 Mahabharats, maybe 5 or 6 Srimad Bhagavatams, a whole bunch of Bhagavad Gitas, and some small books. In addition to everything else that he did. And his writings are like, they're very lofty. Just to give you an idea, this, I like speaking about Jiva Goswami. One of the devotees, some of you know a little bit about homeschooling, right? And the forerunner, the acharya of homeschooling is Arudha Mataji in Boise, Idaho. You know her, or of her at least. So her first son did his PhD at Oxford University on 3 verses from one of the Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami. And so you could do, you know, probably 700-800 PhDs just on the Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami, because they're so packed, so potent, spiritually potent. And he's now a tenured professor. I mean, he's Radhika Raman is not, no, Radhika. Yes? Radhika Raman is a brilliant scholarly person, studying from the super brilliant Jiva Goswami's Sandarbhas. And that's just one of the texts. There's 6 parts to it, but it's amazing. And just today I was hearing Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj narrating something from Gopal Champu. Gopal Champu is one of the books written by Jiva Goswami, and there's some history behind the book. When Jiva Goswami went to study under Rupa Goswami did what a guru commonly will do. He'll give the disciple some menial service. Although he was the super scholar, he gave him the service of just preparing leaves for his writing. And Jiva Goswami is very happy to have that service for Rupa Goswami. But his scholarship was unparalleled. So one time, two occasions, this is Ballabhacharya. Some of you from Gujarat, you know Ballabhacharya? Does his name mean anything to you, Ballabhacharya? Ballabhacharya was a contemporary of Lord Chaitanya. He's from the Nimbarka Sampradaya, and he's the founder of the Pushtimarg group. And Vallabhacharya was a great Krishna Bhakta and a contemporary of Lord Chaitanya. So many things are written in Chaitanya Charitamrita, but here's one that's described in Bhakti Ratnakar. When Vallabhacharya was living in Vrindavan, at the same time as Rupa Goswami living in Vrindavan, they had a friendship. And Rupa Goswami said, "You're a wonderful scholar. Could you assist me? Could you read Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, or Nectar Devotion? And if you see some discrepancy or some, you know, like a proofread, and if you see something you doesn't seem right to you, please bring it to my attention. Can you do that service?" And he said, "Yes, I'll do that service." So he came to one passage after some time that he raised some question about to Rupa Goswami. "You're describing the processes other than bhakti are like two witches, bhakti and mukti. Those who want liberation, mukti, and those who want sense gratification, bhakti, they're like two witches." And he said, "That's a little harsh. Can you maybe think of a metaphor that's a little softer, but conveys the meaning?" It was just an aesthetic comment. So Rupa Goswami considered. And Jiva Goswami, meanwhile, heard that Vallabhacharya had found some fault, some discrepancy in Rupa Goswami's writings. So he had a little private meeting with him and let him have it. And gave number of scriptural references that precisely show, state the same thing. It's not just his poetic language. It's a scriptural statement. And here's why the scriptural statement is here, and so on and so on and so on. So Vallabhacharya was convinced. Said, "Very good. You're a good student of Rupa Goswami. Thank you for this." And he went back and informed Rupa Goswami. "You're a student, Jiva. Gave a very nice explanation. And so I take it back. Bhakti and mukti are like witches." Then Rupa Goswami called Jiva and said, "Why have you done this? I've asked him for some service. And he very kindly agreed to do some service. And you're calling him out over here and, you know, saying, why are you speaking like this?" He was, "I'm just protecting your honor. And what you said was fine." And he agreed and said, "You know, don't do like this." So he got some admonishment, although he hadn't done something wrong. Because people that are extremely brilliant and scholarly, if a little pride enters, it can be very devastating. So beware of, even if you're not very scholarly, beware of pride, because pride can destroy everything that's good. Beware of pride. So he was just doing what a spiritual master is supposed to do, keeping his student in a nice position, protected position. Then another incident took place where some debater, a Digvijay pundit, came into Vrindavan looking for someone to debate with. And he heard that Rupa Goswami is the best of all the scholars in Vrindavan, so he went to Rupa Goswami's ashram and said, "I challenge you to a debate." He didn't say about what, just like, "challenge you to a debate." And Rupa Goswami said, "Oh, you're such a brilliant scholar, there's no question of debating with you. I'll just accept defeat." They said, "Very well, if you accept defeat, then you sign. The statement says that you've been defeated by me." "Sure, I'll sign. I've been defeated by you. Very well." And he was going around showing, "I've defeated Rupa Goswami. Just see his signature." Everyone knew his signature. So Jiva Goswami, defending the honor of his spiritual master against this boastful, prideful pundit, he engaged him in debate. And for 3 days, nonstop, he let him have it. Polarized the man. And he left Vrindavan, shamed that this little boy defeated him, or young scholarly person defeated him, the student of Rupa Goswami who wouldn't even bother to debate with me. So Rupa Goswami called Jiva Goswami and said, "What have you done?" "Well, he was taking this paper around and saying, I've defeated Rupa Goswami, and I didn't like that. Because I knew it's not possible. So to correct this man's pride, I let him have it. And Rupa Goswami said, we're Vaishnavas, we don't engage ourselves in this wrangling and this kind of thing. And to be a resident of Vrindavan, one has to be very humble and pure in heart. And I think you're not fit to live in Vrindavan just now. You should leave Vrindavan. Just like that. Leave Vrindavan. So what's Jiva Goswami going to do? His spiritual master told him to leave Vrindavan. So he left Vrindavan. While he was living, it was upstream along the river Jamuna. He was living in a cave along the bank of the river Jamuna. And he wrote a book, a very famous book, one of his many famous books called Gopal Champu. Gopal Champu is very much thematically like some of the other writings of the Goswamis. It's little cameo pictures of the pastimes of Krishna in Vrindavan. Gopal Champu. Very nice. Sanatan Goswami wrote one like that also. It's not the full Leela. It's a meditation on a little snapshot of the pastime. It's very rasika. It's just involving the reader in meditating upon and hearing the glories of and the wonderful pastimes and qualities of the Lord in sequence. So in that Gopal Champu, there's one reference that I was just hearing from Bhakti Chaitanya Swami, and I'll share with you. Then I'll say something else. There's one pastime that's described in Gopal Champu when Krishna had his third birthday. Janmashtami day, birthday number 3. 3 years old, Krishna announced to Nanda and Yashoda that I want to go herding the calves. No, I want to go herding the cows. Think of someone that's 3 years old and they want to go herding cows. Ananda Maharaj says, the cows, they're so big and you're so little. You're just 3 years old. But Krishna was insistent. No, I want to herd the cows. So some back and forth, and Ananda Maharaj finally said, all right, you can herd the calves. So we'll have a big festival because it's the commencement of this dharmic situation where this is not just our family tradition, but it's dharma. He's a 3-year-old boy that's going to be Krishi Goraksha. He's going to give protection to the cows, like as our Vaishya community's dharma is. So they had Krishna's going to herd the calves festival. And everyone brought different gifts for Krishna. Someone brought a buffalo horn. Ooh, so Krishna could call the calves in the course of their activity. Someone gave Krishna a rope. Nice new rope. So if one of the calves goes straying this way or that way, he could capture the calf and tie the calf and keep the calf along with the herd. And someone gave Krishna his first flute. Jiva Goswami writes in Gopal Champu, when he was 3 years old, he got his first flute. Doesn't describe, how many holes and how long it was, like it does in Nectar of Devotion. His first flute. And Mother Yashoda gave Krishna special shoes, because she didn't want Krishna to go out into the forest barefoot, 3-year-old boy. So there's a name for it, and it's those shoes that are real pointy and they curl at the end. You know which ones I'm talking about. But then they did. Now it's like little mirrors and colors and things. But then it was jewels. Very opulent. And an umbrella so that Krishna wouldn't have to be out in the sun. And someone to carry the umbrella. Those three things. Shoes, an umbrella, and someone to carry the umbrella. And Krishna said no. I'll only accept these gifts if you provide 4 shoes for each of the calves. Now, it doesn't say how many calves there were, but there were 9 lakhs of cows, so it must have been a lot of calves, times 4, times an umbrella, however many those are, times so many servants to care, because I can't accept this service. And Mother Jesoda said, but they're cows. They already have hooves. They don't need shoes. And they're used to being out in the sun. They don't need an umbrella. But your skin is so delicate. He said, no, I'm not going to take unless these are all provided. Now, it doesn't describe what happened. But Krishna didn't accept Mother Jasoda's shoes. Because his interest in protecting the cows was accepting them as worshipable, not I'm better, I've got shoes and umbrella, and they have nothing. That was Krishna's lesson at 3 years old. Govinda, one who gives protection and pleasure to the cows. So there's another section later in Gopal Champu. It's a very beautifully written book, and there are some nice translations of it available. But I recommend you read Srimad Bhagavatam before you run off and buy a Gopal Champu and start reading. Read Srimad Bhagavatam with the Bhaktivedanta purports. But there's a section, listen carefully, there's a section that's describing the relationship of Radha and Krishna, where it describes that Radha and Krishna were married. Now, the six Goswamis and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu don't speak like that or don't write like that. There's Swakya and Parakya. Swakya is a conjugal relationship in marriage, husband and wife. Swakya. Parakya is the other kind, relationship between a man and a woman, not in marriage. So the Goswamis and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describe the Leela. This is Krishna, of course. The Leela is where Krishna is apparently, through Leela, associating with the gopis and Radharani, not through the medium of marriage. That's Parakya. So he wrote Gopal Champu in such a way that he, Jiva Goswami, was supporting Swakya. Because at the time of the Goswamis in Vrindavan, believe it or not, there was a controversy. In spiritual subject matters, it seems to be since time immemorial. Some people say this, some people say that, and they make their arguments for this and for that, and they disagree. You've noticed that, right? It happens. It happened at the time of the Goswamis. There were persons who, scholarly persons in Vrindavan, who didn't like this teaching. Following the mood that Rupa Goswami had presented to Jiva Goswami through these two examples that I gave you, the Balaba example and the scholar, debater, Digvijay Pandit person, don't take the position of arguing. So he took the position of accommodating. Read carefully when you read Sri Brahma Samhita, if you ever, you know, have the patience to do that. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments in that longest of purports in the book that Jiva Goswami wrote in this way. He doesn't detail it, but now I'm giving you the detail. He wrote in this way supporting Swakya. But Jiva Goswami cannot do anything other than be in accord with Rupa Goswami, who is in accord with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who taught Parakya. Because it's just a leela. It's not morality. It's a leela. Anyway. So, Jiva Goswami wrote the book, Gopal Champu, and he was feeling pain in his heart that he had displeased Rupa Goswami. So in disgust with himself, he threw the manuscript into the Jamuna River. And that same day, Sanatan Goswami was taking his bath downstream at where the Brahma Vimohan Leela took place. Some of you have been there. What's the name of the kund? Something kund. So it's along the Jamuna River. And he saw this manuscript floating by, and he reached out and looked at it and said, I recognize the handwriting. This is Jiva Goswami's handwriting. He started reading it, and he was appreciating the brilliance of the message that he was writing. So then he put two and two together, and Jiva Goswami is living upstream. So he walked along the bank of the Jamuna, and he found Jiva Goswami, because he had been gone for a year. No one knew where he was, if he was alive, or what had happened. So when he found Jiva was crying, and, you know, I've offended Rupa Goswami, what am I to do? Sanatan Goswami said, I'll take care of this. You just come with me. So he followed him. And keeping the manuscript in his bag, he went to Rupa Goswami's Bhajan Kutir and said, My dear brother, I have a question for you, a philosophical question. What is that? What is the number one teaching in all of Lord Chaitanya's teaching? What's the most prominent teaching? Immediately, Rupa Goswami said, Jivadaya, compassion upon the living beings. He said, very good. Well, I have here one jiva. And please show your daya to this jiva. And Jiva Goswami fell at his feet, and Rupa Goswami forgave him, and he made his residence in Vrindavan again. In the course of time, Rupa and Sanatan left this world. They were his uncle. They were elder to him, elder even to his father. And so he became the principal acharya in all of Vrindavan amongst the followers of Lord Chaitanya. And he wrote prodigiously. He gathered a library of the writings of the Goswamis. He engaged brahmanas who were making hand copies of those literatures to preserve them for posterity, for us. He oversaw, along with Raghunath Das Goswami, the excavation of Radhakund and Shyamakund. He sometimes made his residence there at Radhakund. There's a little temple. The deity that he worshipped was a deity of Radha Damodar, made by the hand of Rupa Goswami for Jiva Goswami to worship. And he worshipped, being instructed how to do the worship by Gopal Bhatta Goswami. He did the worship and engaged others in the worship of Radha Damodar. And he gave one of the greatest gifts of his life, in addition to the other things mentioned, his writings especially. He personally instructed three. Jiva Goswami instructed as Shiksha disciples, three personalities, Srinivasacharya, Narottam Das Thakur, and Shyamananda. Thoroughly in the bhakti teachings. Thoroughly. And then sent them to go to other parts of India and give the teachings of the Goswamis to the rest of the world, along with a bullock cart loaded with the Goswami literatures. Original copies. Handmade copies. And that's a whole other story. So he had the vision to spread, as Lord Chaitanya wished, to have the teachings given far and wide. He personally trained others. He was the, in our line of disciplic succession, one of the most prominent acharyas and certainly prolific writer. And he left this world on Makara Sankranti. So we're honoring his disappearance day today. Jiva Goswami Prabhupada ki jai. So 8:30. I plan to end at 8:30, and I did a pretty good job. Any comments or questions? Yes.
I always watch yourself appreciating Prabhupada's writings. Other than that, you would always feel yourself more happy in appreciating Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj Goswami's writings and Jiva Goswami's writings. So I was kind of curious to know, is there any different styles they both follow in the writings?
Style? Is the word that you're using? Difference of style?
Styles are like...
They're deep. Bhaktisiddhanta's writings are extremely scholarly. I mean, high language. So it's, the high language isn't fun. It means you have to have a dictionary, look up every third or fourth word. And that's if you have a good vocabulary. He used the English language. He had mastery of the English language like we don't. But when you look things up in the dictionary and you see the words that he used, it's the precise word. It's not just conversational, it's scholastic. Because he memorized dictionaries. He had that kind of a brain. He could read something once and remember it perfectly. We can't. So he knew how to use language like we don't. Even if it's our first language and it wasn't his first language. That was the kind of scholar that Bhaktisiddhanta was. So aside from language, the message that he presents is very deep and profound. And with realization. I mean, it's clear when you read, because sometimes his writing is like, you don't need a dictionary every third, fourth word. You can read even a couple of paragraphs without a dictionary, without referring. But when he writes, like Chaitanya Charitamrita is an example. He wrote a commentary on Chaitanya Charitamrita in Bengali. And it's very readable. At least, you know, what the translator did, it's very readable. But it's realized. It's very profound. And detailed, and detailed, and detailed, and detailed, and detailed. He's very precise. That's Bhaktisiddhanta. And Jiva Goswami is just... It's like sutras. When he writes, it's filled with meaning. Filled with meaning. Just, you know, read some of it and you'll see. When he wrote commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, he didn't just write one, he wrote three. One was, as Prabhupada did, you know, word for word and commentary for each verse of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. If that wasn't enough, the Sandarbhas is also a commentary and it's on the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam. And you can just go, you know, just it's like diving, plunging deep, and you just keep going and going and going and going and going, and you don't know how far you're going. Then he comes back up to the next anuchet and this goes down again and down again and down again. It's just he's just fathomless. There's no bottom to Jiva Goswami's depth. It's like that. And then he connects something in this Sandarbha to that Sandarbha. You know, like he has this brain, and then he didn't have a library. I mean, excuse me, he didn't have a computer. He just had a brain. He didn't have to do a word search like we do with Folio and just, you know, enter a word and see where it is. Okay, there's where it is. It's just, it's there in his brain. He just had that capacity. As he's writing something in Sri Brahma Samhita, he says, and this is elsewhere described in Krishna Sandarbha in depth. You can find it in Anuchet such and such. Just, you know, genius. Spiritual genius. And he knew the arguments against the Purva Pakshas. Those, some people say. So he knew what all the arguments were against what he was saying, and he presented the arguments against what he was saying, and then he would address the arguments against what he was saying. And he said, to those arguments, some people will say. And he would address that, you know, the next layer of argument. And so, you know, he knew the whole territory. And it wasn't just he made statements, there was scriptural support for each of the statements. incredible. I don't know how to describe what his style is. Genius. Just your mouth is hanging open going. Not like, what did he say? Because it's clear what he's saying. Just the brilliance of how he presents what he's presenting. Thorough and comprehensive and deep. The feeling is, let me just grab onto his dhoti. Wherever he's going, I want to go there. And it's not just philosophical things, but also lila things. Very, very deep. He describes the Damodar lila, for example, in such an amazing way. Gopal Champu, Damodar lila. You have something more?
I do not know much more detail on that. So my understanding is that Guru Goswami must have written more sandarbhas. But is there
six?
Six sandarbhas. But my understanding is like it should have a more depth knowledge, more deeper in philosophy, kind of thing. That's my understanding.
Read Srimad Bhagavatam at least two times before you go into the sandarbhas. Okay. That's what your question is. When should I read them?
No.
Read Srimad Bhagavatam at least twice.
I'm not sure whether I can do
it. Read Srimad Bhagavatam twice. Guided study before you go to the sandarbhas.
So my question is there any, because I have not heard or seen any lecture on any sandarbhas.
Don't worry about it.
Because I was kind of little, like,
don't worry about it. Just read Srimad Bhagavatam. I'm mentioning it so that you know it's out there. After some time, the BBT is going to publish Gopi Puranadana's translation and his translation of Baladev Vidyabhusan's commentary of Tattva Sandarbha, Coming Attractions. And that's one of the six. Because the commentary is there, then you can read it. The others without commentary. You could read Radhika Raman's PhD thesis and it'll be, but from a Vaishnava, from a Gaudiya Vaishnava, it'll be more understandable than just reading the sandarbhas without commentary. Don't worry about it. But in many places in Chaitanya Charitamrita, when you get to that stage, you'll find references to the sandarbhas, Prabhupada quotes, because it's the topics of Chaitanya Charitamrita are postgraduate level. So Prabhupada naturally quotes the sandarbhas and, relevant passages. So little by little you'll get. Little by little. Little bite-sized, chew them for a while, real thoroughly before you swallow, and then, go on like that. From the purports of Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita, you'll get a little picture. Like Krishna Sandarbha, for example. That's one of the six Sandarbhas. One of the main themes, not the entire message, but one of the main themes of Krishna Sandarbha is explaining Ete Changsa Kala Pungsa Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. Got a chorus going on here. Why it is that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna Sandarbha. And, from the different perspectives of other people who have another idea, another idea, another idea. Why Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's, a big topic. So, there are many different perspectives. So there's several hundred anuchets that go into that topic. You can just read the purport to that verse in the Bhagavatam, and you know that's sufficient for you. Okay. Someone else? Okay. We're done. You have something? No. Okay. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.